session number 22658, reel 8.
I presume that there's not much you can do with air bursts showering above you.
Not at all. And of course, the other thing was, I'm pretty sure the Stukas were coming in as well. And of course, we'd heard all about those. And of course, like in Tobruk, they took a pasting with Stukas and that. So we were wake up to the screaming, the screamers they had on the thing. So that, well, I mean, it might be all right for frightened hell out of civilians and that, but didn't have that much effect on us because the majority of us knew all about it. So all you had to do was make sure that you weren't anywhere near the, when the bombs come down. But getting back to the situation when we first got into that flat, now I'm not too sure. We might have the right and left section sergeants and the troop commander would have to do a reconnaissance in regards to each gun site. And you've got to bear in mind that we've also got to take consideration where the infantry are, mainly because if we were selected a gun site beyond the infantry, well, let's say the front line, you're out there like a cocky on a biscuit tin, see? And that all had to be sorted out where you had to wait for them to...
Can you describe to us then your understanding of the layout at Tel Eliza?
Yes. With Tel Eliza station, on the eastern part of Tel Eliza station, in other words, the Cairo side, the 42nd 48th Battalion company ran from the their line was from the. The railway line, that's the one that went up to Brook and on. The particular company held a line from the railway in a northerly direction, that's towards the Mediterranean Sea. They did whatever their fortifications were required there, and from the, and then there was a big gap from their front line. When I say front line, it really wasn't the front line. The front line ran along the railway line to a cutting, railway cutting. This other line, it was other fortifications or the company lines, ran from the railway line in a northerly direction. So that was the boundary, and on the Cairo side of it, there was basically nothing. Though there were some artillery guns further back, but. There must have been troops further to the east, but they wouldn't be in a battle position. They were just in reserve sort of business. So, to me, I often wondered if they'd forgotten all about us at Tel Eliza and just went further to the east, Cairo side. They might have had an easier run than what really happened afterwards. So that was on that particular side, and then there were other battalions to the westward, running along the railway line and in the cuttings and in a westerly direction. So basically, they had a square running from the railway line is the front, and then two sides, east and the western, and then the sea was the Mediterranean Sea was at the northern side. So that's roughly the formation. Mightn't be geometrically that way, but that's
that was the Alamein box.
It could have been. Could have been.
What then was? Did you feel the importance of Telerasa station?
Well, it was. First of all, it was a fairly good situation to be in, a defensive manner, because there was a lot of open space, so there were undulations to the front. They didn't really matter about to the seaward side, because that was the area that was held by our own troops. So, well, what happened was the Axis troops attacked us from the west, because that was the way they were coming, and west and south, sort of southwest, and that was like the main attack to start with. But of course they used their artillery and aircraft for anything that moved around the in the box area. But getting back to from my particular situation, I'm not too sure. I think I couldn't have left two guns sitting out in a flat area while I went off with the troop commander to do that. So they might have been parked back behind some rise, and we went off and did our particular reconnaissance, and so my side of it was that I had the two guns sighted along the railway line. And the gun that I was to look after, I was pretty lucky to get a position by a little rise, not facing the railway line, but because two pounders got 360 degrees traverse, and you could swing it anywhere. So I would have probably had a field of fire of, or say 270 degrees or something like that, because the little hillock was partially hidden behind that. Something like what the tanks used to do is hide down behind a hill, what was called a hull down position. And then the other gun was towards the eastern side, and on the understanding that the infantry would be down there with him. So fortunately, we were able. The gun commanders were able to sight their guns on where they reckon was within in a area that was allocated to them. They picked the spot, sort of business, and unless I know some of them, some of the troop commanders said, "Well, that's where you're going. That's the end of it." So. With us, we're pretty fortunate. We had could make our own decision where the gun would be actually sighted. And of course, then again, because there's plenty of rock underneath the top surface, so we are there, but we couldn't get down down deep enough actually to be able to get better protection and that. So with the gun commanders and myself, we eventually decided where the spots were, with a bit of latitude if you ran into a rock or something like that. You couldn't do anything about that. So then once we'd done that, when then the guns would come in and they'd have to hop into it and dig the gun in, and also dig the holes for themselves. Mm-hmm. And
I wanted to discuss with you, what the feelings were generally about command. And I wanted to speak to you about Leo Lyon and his position in all of this.
Yeah. Well, Leo and I are pretty close friends. Nowadays we are. He's very strict with his discipline, and whatever he was directed to do, he did, and he made sure we damn well did it. And he was regarded as a pretty good soldier. There's nothing, nothing derogatory in regards to his ability. And I mean, when you consider he was a permanent army man, I'm pretty sure he was in the artillery, Fremantle, prior to the war, and of course they were pretty disciplined people, or perms were anyway. But if we had to have whatever the schedule of training was, we did it, which I could say in some of the other troops they damn well didn't do.
How was strict officers seen?
Yeah, well, with Leo, there's no beg your pardons about it. If something had to be done, it was done. And even we might try to sway him, and I'm not talking about difficult things.
Just let the plane go over. Sorry.
Whereas some of the others, they could get away with not doing something. You've got to bear in mind that these blokes have been in the army 2 and 3 years, and you can imagine yourself doing gun drill for 2 or 3 years. And every time you come out of the battle line, you'd have to start all over again. Foot drill, rifle drill, and all those sort of things when you're an experienced battle man or something of that nature. So there was no doubt about your fighting capabilities and things like that. And as I think I mentioned before, we were in the whole group were virtually individualists in battle, and then when they came back to training, it was pretty hard to get them to settle down.
Surely it's not a good thing to have individualists in a company, a platoon.
Oh, yeah, the NCOs were most of them, well, in our outfit. I mean, they used to fix things up themselves. someone cut up roughly, or they'd fix him up somehow or other, not regimentally, but that'd be. And I mean, if he went overboard in whatever he was doing, and it was in the end, you would you might have to do something about straightening him out in under army or regimental. Place them under arrest or something of that nature, but there's never done any of that sort.
What about the higher command and how they were operating things and
well
affecting your position?
Well, it's depending on whether you're in a training camp situation or you're in the battle line. They're two different situations. And you know, an officer wasn't up to standard sort of business, and things were a bit grim, there was the troop sergeant or someone one of the sergeants or something, and sort of back him up and sort of cover up for any defects if he did do.
Given your position in relation to not really having known what you were up for until you were in the situation, how did you then look on higher command? On the way they put you in this position, for instance, without warning, without really teaching you what you needed to know?
Well, I don't, in theory, they, I mean, they trained in battle procedures and things of that nature. A lot depends upon you had permanent soldiers, and you had civilian people that had been commissioned. They may have been in the militia and that, and they joined, voluntarily and things of that nature, and had a flair for military procedures and things like that, and.
I was thinking more about the general feeling of people like Auchinleck, for instance.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm sort of coming to the situation where I think a lot had to do with how successful a fellow or a commander was. And, of course, I mean, you've also got to bear in mind that when you've got a fellow like Churchill in charge of the whole procedure, if he said, "Well, you take Crete for a start," I don't think any of the senior commanders really wanted to be involved in that situation. But they were told to go in there, and in they had to go. So. If it was a failure, well, you knew that it was going to be one to start with. But if it wasn't one where an action was taken on an individual commander's appreciation of the situation, and it was a botched up thing and lots of people killed, well, he wouldn't get too much credit from down the line. So you had those sorts of things when and you've also got to take into consideration when you're making a decision about someone is how much support he's got at the time, whether he's got naval assistance or from the Air Force and things like that. Quite frequently, some were sent into action where they never had any support at all. Those are the sorts of things that, you know, you've got to take into consideration when you're going to decide on whether a man's useless or otherwise. And you take Walker and Lick and I just can't think of some of the other. They were quite capable people, but they had problems from up above them, and then supplies and not being able to get support when they wanted it. But of course, when Montgomery came on the scene, and of course by that time the supplies had improved, the Americans were in, and there were plenty of supplies, so he was in a fortunate position apart from his capabilities.
Well, we can talk about Montgomery
later on, but I mean, just sort of highlighting.
Given all of that, what do you reckon the average soldier felt about the higher command at that time when you were at Telalisa?
I don't think they. I mean, as far as we were concerned, within our own division, with Moorshead and the brigade commanders, who were there. I might say we're damn lucky.
Okay.
We're damn lucky.
Tell us then about your initial contact with the enemy in regard... I understand that there were quite a lot of Italian prisoners being taken when you arrived.
Yes. Well, whilst we were sighting up our guns and towards the evening, the prisoners were coming in then. I think they were mainly Italians. I might be wrong, but I think they were. They just passed through our lines, and there'd only be a few guards on them. And I think they were pretty happy to be out of it, but. There were later on, when a few of the Germans came through, there were different sort of people. You had to, not me, but whoever was in charge of them had to be a bit careful with them. And of course, then they were just taken away, and that's the last we saw them.
What was known of the German tactics?
Once again, it was my first association with action. So, as far as the tactics of the Germans were concerned, was this. More of learning out of the book or listening to the experiences of others, and plus the fact that they were well commanded, well equipped, and pretty efficient soldiers, mainly because of the experiences they had had in other. Other battlefields and things of that nature, plus the fact that the German discipline in other words, they do as they're told and they did it. And I must say that as far as the Africa Corps were concerned, it was near enough to... a fair fight, except they had better gear than we did. But so we what, you know, as far as tank warfare was concerned, well, I mean, they were with the superior people in the world at the time, and so we had to realise that we were undergunned. There only we did have some 6-pounders, but as far as I was concerned, we only had 2-pounders. They had the advantage on us with their firepower, so we just had to make the best of the situations and not do anything that was ridiculous.
As I understand, the Germans were to come in on the sort of 10th and the 11th of July. Yes. Can you tell us your understanding of that situation? Yes.
The infantry on the 10th of July were on the south side of the railway line. That was one particular company, and they were dug in, shallowed in, and there was a tank attack that came from behind high ground and came right across that frontage, moving from in a westerly direction towards Tel Eliza station. Now there were two guns from our troop, that was H troop, were sighted in that area, and there were also other guns sighted in the area as well. What I'm trying to indicate that they were strategically sighted, not just plonked around anywhere. Now the tanks came in, I'm pretty sure it was in the afternoon, and they went right across the front, and this is where I saw, made my blood boil a bit, was that the tanks were running over the slit trenches and reversing or swiveling on top of the slit trenches. And of course everybody went berserk about that, because that was a bit not fair cricket. That was the only incident that I saw where, you know, I didn't sort of appreciate that sort of game. But what happened, I never opened fire on that situation because of these other guns that crossed the front. There were quite a number of tanks knocked out there by those guns that were sighted in those positions. So that was what sort of happened on the 10th of July, to the best of my...
What was the feeling then of the tanks being destroyed?
Well, what with them running over the blokes, that really, they couldn't care damn less. I mean, as long as they got them, and if they caught on fire, well... that'll make up for a bit of running over the blokes and the slit trenches. But I'm not too sure how many there might have been, 3, 4, or 5 tanks knocked off in there. But the various stories about, you know, fellows trying to knock off the tank commanders who had, you know, they had their heads stuck out of the turrets. And I think there might have been one or two of them got knocked off. But that the machine gun is that's the biggest machine gun I've built it into them, but of course it wouldn't do much damage.